A man was on an airplane one time and he was sitting next to another gentleman. The other gentleman noticed that his wedding ring was on his right hand. He said, "Sir, are you married?" He said, "Yes." He says, "Well, your wedding ring is on the wrong hand." He said, "I married the wrong woman." There was a guy who was crying over a tombstone at a cemetery. He was just wailing. Just wailing. Why did you have to die? Why did you have to die? Why did you have to die? A man who was there visiting another lost relative said, "Sir, I'm so sorry. Is that your wife?" He said, "No." "Is that your mother?" "No." "Is that your father?" "No." "Why did you have to die?" "Well, who is it?" "My wife's first husband." Many men are like Adam, who said, "It was the woman, God, that you gave me. And that's why I'm in this mess." Many a man has either said or felt like saying, "I would have been much better off today if it were not for marrying you." We have tried to give a theological, not a sociological, rationale for the role of a husband. We have tried to, from Ephesians 5, dig out the wealth that is here, that a husband loves his wife by becoming her savior. He loves his wife by becoming her sanctifier. Today we conclude the husband's portion by saying a man loves his wife by becoming her satisfier. He says in verse 28, "So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself." What God says here is that when you look at a man's wife, you can get a pretty good idea of what he thinks about himself. If the wife is miserable all the time, that's because he's a miserable man. If his wife is unhappy all the time, it's because he's an unhappy man. What the Bible says is that when a man looks into a mirror, looks into his wife, he's looking at a mirror reflecting back to him himself. That's what the scripture says. What's the concept here of satisfaction or satisfying a wife? Well, he makes it clear that it has to do with meeting needs. Jesus has taken it upon himself as husband of his bride, the church, to take it upon his own self the responsibility of meeting his bride's needs. Philippians 4:19 makes it clear, does it not? "I will supply all your needs according to my riches and glory in Christ Jesus." There is no need that the church has that the husband Jesus does not take it upon himself to address. Now, most men, when they lie in while dating, promise to meet all the needs. "I'm going to take care of you, baby. Papa's here, whatever you need." But I know what you're saying. I didn't know she was that needy. You and I, as the bride of Jesus Christ, need him perpetually, every day. Do you know why Jesus has committed himself to meet the needs of the church? Because he understands something about leadership that most men don't. The higher you go up the ladder of leadership, the greater servant you become. See, we define leadership in terms of being the boss. I'm in charge here. This is my home. I am the king of this castle. When the disciples got into a debate about who would be the greatest in the kingdom, Jesus says, you will always know who the leader is, because the greatest among you will be your servant. And that's why when Jesus Christ was with the upper in the upper room with his disciples, and it was the habit of the day that there would be a servant who would wipe the feet of the guest off the dust from the Judean roads that were dusty. Nobody moved. Nobody wanted to take the role. That is, except Jesus, when he donned the towel and the basin and he cleaned his disciples' feet. Peter said, wait a minute, you can't do this. You're in charge. Jesus says, it is because I'm in charge that I do this. To meet your mate's needs as men means you become a servant. It means you take the initiative to service the needs of your mate, because Jesus takes the initiative to service the needs of his church. Jesus met our needs when we weren't even here asking for him to meet them, because he did it because he understood that the definition of biblical leadership includes, it's not limited to, but it includes being a servant. Now, of course, Jesus is Lord, and we're going to talk about how your women ought to treat you as Lord. But you'll sure make it conducive by becoming a servant. What this verse says is, how you feel about yourself is reflected in how you love your wife. So whatever you do for you, make sure you double it. That's a simple principle. Whatever you do for you, you double it, because she is you, or an extension of you, as you'll see. Men spend time meeting their needs, whether it's exercise or eating or dressing or whatever it is. He says that the wife is the continuation of him, because a man ought to love his own wife like he loves himself. Now, the important definition of love, we said biblical love, agape, transcends emotion, as opposed to phileo, friendship, relational kind of love, which always is driven by emotion. That's the word, I like you. Phileo is I like you, I feel good about you. God calls us to agape, which is a choice kind of love. I choose to meet your needs even when I'm not feeling like it. Because guess what, man? That's what we do for ourselves. You're sitting down, your stomach is hungry, you're watching a football game, you're dying to get something to eat, but you don't feel like getting up. Emotionally, you don't want to get up off that couch. However, if the hunger pains are screaming, hollering, and knocking you around, you will override your tiredness and make your way to the refrigerator. Why? Because meeting that need is more important than your emotional feeling about not moving. The need drives it. Because biblical love is driven by the meeting of needs. Now, I know you're scared already, because you're saying she's going to take advantage of that, preacher. If I begin meeting her needs, she's going to take advantage of that, and I'm going to be misused. You mean sort of like we do Jesus? He can't bless us enough, we complaining. He can't meet our needs enough, we complaining. Why didn't he do this for me? Why didn't he do that for me? Yeah, there is a risk involved in making it your goal to meet the needs of the other person. That is a risk. That's what love does. It takes that risk. It is an act of the will. Now, in order for you to meet needs, you've got to know them. Hold your finger here and turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. Ladies, you read every day 1 Peter 3, 1 to 6. We coming at you next week. Verse 7 says, you husbands, Likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. I'm going to reference that verse a number of times, but the first reference I want to make to it is he says, dwell with your wives in an understanding way. The King James Version tells you to know your wife. You can't meet needs you don't understand. You've got to understand a need. Now, here's the problem. The problem is understanding a woman. We are told to study, men are told to study two things. We're told to study the Bible, and in this verse, we're told to study our wives. Why? Because both can be difficult to interpret. To understand a wife is to visit a foreign country where you've got to learn a second language. Because many times she is speaking from how she feels, but you're answering what she should do. She's sitting down and she's sharing with you, and you coming up with solutions to a problem she has not fully explained. The reason why you coming up with a solution to a problem she's not fully explained is you don't want to take the time to hear all that. In your mind, she is taking 2 hours to explain something that really only takes 5 minutes. So what you offer to do is cut off an hour of 55 minutes worth of conversation. Let me help you. This is where you're going. This is what you mean. Let me help you, and I'm going to solve it so we don't have to spend 2 hours discussing it. But you don't understand. You see, in your language, my language, our language, we say a word, and we understand the surface meaning of the word, and we act on it. But she wants to describe that thing. Because she does not want you to understand it intellectually. She wants you to feel it with her. She wants you to emote with her. She wants you to tears start welling up. She wants to see your eyes. She wants to see that you focusing in. That's why 1 Peter says, dwell with your wives. The Greek word dwell means to live. It means to be there long enough to understand what she is saying and what she meant by what she said. That's why when you offer a solution, she getting mad. You wonder why she getting mad over a problem you trying to fix. Because she wants to know you are more concerned about her than her problem. She just doesn't want you to fix the problem. She wants you to fix her as you address the problem. That takes time, because part of her getting fixed is the ability to fully express, to fully unveil how she feels. It takes time to learn a foreign language. You can try to rush and learn Spanish when you can't speak Spanish, learn French, but you will not understand what's going on because you've not taken the time to learn the language. What he is saying here is that we must dwell or live there long enough to understand. I come here and I preach on Sunday, I preach on Wednesday. You get a 50-minute message, average time, 50-minute message. But you have to understand, it takes me 12 hours in the study to produce a 50-minute message. What you don't see is what's behind the scenes. The time spent, the study, the books, all that goes on to preparing a 50-minute message. You go out and you say, appreciate the message. Sometimes that irritates me. I want to hear, I appreciate them all them hours you spend. And I appreciate 12 years of education post-high school so that you got a master's and a doctorate degree. I appreciate the fact that you got all them books in your library and stuff. Make me feel good. I didn't spend 12 hours, you talking about good message. In other words, it's what you do behind the scenes that makes what you do out front valid. We want credit as men for what we do out front when nobody's seeing anything behind the scenes. And behind the scenes, that listening, that dwelling time, is what it's going to take in order to understand not only what she says, but how she feels. That takes a servant. It's a servant who gives up a football game or portion of a football game and says, we need to talk. It's a servant that says at 3 o'clock this afternoon when the Cowboys are on. I'm running out of servants here this morning. The Ritz-Carlton is one of the most famous hotel chains in America. I was at a conference at the Ritz-Carlton speaking, and the folks told me we always go to the Ritz-Carlton. I said, why? He says, because their service is like no other. Virtually every other hotel, if you need something, you go to the concierge. And the concierge will give you good instruction where to go to get it, how to work it out. Not at the Ritz-Carlton. At the Ritz-Carlton, you are told, if you work there, that when a customer has a need, you not only tell them how the need is met, you take them to getting the needs met. So at the Ritz-Carlton, somebody is always taking you somewhere. Or if you have a problem, they'll say, look, you stay seated. I'll go get it. At the Ritz-Carlton, they're known for their service, and so people keep showing up. We wonder why our wives don't show up when we need them, and that's because we want to be a concierge. We want to give quick answers rather than taking them to the solution, leading them through the scenario, walking them through the details. That takes time. Time that we used to give when we were dating that we can't seem to find now. Now, it's not because we don't have time. Because just look at the remote. There is time available. It's just we don't have time for them. Therefore, they feel like they're not understood. Therefore, they are complaining and not satisfied. Discontent. Frustrated because the investment level is so low. You say, well, how do you know if I'm fulfilling this? There's a simple way. Here's the test. When you go home today, take a sheet of paper and divide it in half. On one side says, she serves me. The other side, I serve her. On her side, put everything she does directly for you. She cooks your meal, that's directly for you. If she washes your clothes, that's directly for you. The things that she does that directly benefit you, you put that on a list. Then on your side of the paper, you put down a list of everything you do that directly benefits her. Now here it is. If her list is longer than your list, she is the husband and you are the wife. You know why? Because if her list is longer than your list, the greatest among you shall be your servant. She is the greater because she is the greater servant. Therefore, she has established herself as the leader. You're saying, why? My wife won't let me lead. It says a man is to love his wife like he loves his own body. All you do for you, you do for her. You're the greatest. That means you're the greatest servant. So that means you need to either lengthen your list or shorten hers, or a combination of both. For she is to never outserve you. All right. You know waiters you want to give big tips to? Those who go above and beyond the call of duty in serving. What can I get you, sir? Are you okay, sir? I'll be right back, sir. Be glad to do that for you, sir. With the right attitude, not here. And the better they serve, the bigger the tip. Why do you give them a big tip? That's their job. Oh, but they served. A lot of men want a big tip. 11 o'clock at night. She look at your service all day and say, here. Moving right along. How do you serve her? He says, two words, verse 29. For no one ever hates his own flesh, but he nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. You see the model? Christ to the church, a man to a woman. What does the man do? The same two things that Christ does to his church. He nourishes it and cherishes it. Those are the two words. That is what every woman needs, whether she knows it or not. That is what every woman wants, and that therefore is what every man ought to supply. Nourishing and cherishing. The word nourish means to feed in order to mature. Jesus provides all we need at salvation. Why? To mature us into disciples. When we're saved, when we got married to him, he didn't stop, he started. That's why you don't date to marry, you marry to date. See, in American culture, you date to marry, then you wonder what happened after we got married. Well, we stopped dating, that's what happened. In the Bible, you hardly sometimes even knew the person you married, but you married to date. In other words, it was a lifetime of getting to know and nourishing the other person. Jesus supplies our needs in order to help us to blossom. When she married you, she should be better off because somebody is undistractedly investing in her blossoming. She is going to flourish under your regime in a way she couldn't flourish under her father's regime because her father had his own wife, had multiple children. She is your wife, and she is to flourish. The U.S. Army says, be all you can be. A husband's job is to make her all she can be. Nourish has to do with ongoing maintenance. You know, you buy a product, and you get a maintenance contract in order to keep it working correctly. We get married and sign the contract, but forget the maintenance agreement. Nourishing is continuing to keep the oil changed, continuing to keep the tires rotated. It's continuing to do the things that keep the thing working properly. A man nourishes his wife in five ways. First of all, he nourishes his wife with his words of affirmation. He becomes her cheerleader. He applauds her. Instead of simply saying, thank you for dinner, nobody cooks potatoes like you. Now, thank you is one thing, but words of affirmation, nobody cooks potatoes like you. I would rather eat here at home with you than any fine restaurant in town. The five-star can't compare with my six-star cook. Words of affirmation. You say, I don't know how to do that. You did it when you were dating. Words of affirmation. You look beautiful today. A second way that you nourish is by going back to a quality time where you are. Have a listening time. Perhaps it's around the breakfast table. It can be made convenient to your schedule or lunch or dinner, but regularly saying, you know what I want to do? I just want to listen. I want to understand you. I want to hear you talk. But that problem you were telling me about that I didn't have time to listen to yesterday, I'm going to situate myself here, and I want you to take all the time you need to fully understand what you're going through. That trauma at work that's got you all nervous, I can give you advice about what you ought to do, but I want to understand how you feel. And that means the investment of time. A third way is through receiving of gifts. Yeah. receiving of gifts. And every gift doesn't have to be a diamond ring. Because the point of the gift is not the gift. The point of the gift is you were on my mind. You know, I was out of town on a business trip. I was at the airport, and I couldn't hardly focus on the plane. You were so much on my mind. And so when I went, and I got a little gift shop. I went to the gift shop, and I just happened to see this little card, and I just picked up this $1.55 card that simply says, "Just because I love you." And I just want to give you this. Now, that's more valuable than a diamond. Because you can give a diamond and not think about the person for whom you purchased it. But when you gave thought to the gift, and it wasn't an official time to give it, acts of service, doing the unexpected, washing the dishes when you don't know how to wash dishes, surprise at this morning, if your wife makes up the bed every day, say, no, you don't make up the bed today. That takes you 2 minutes. But all of a sudden, she became tremendously important because you did something that's normally her job. Acts of service. And then physical touch, that is non-sexual touch. Not a touch that says I'm going somewhere. A touch that simply says I want to be close to you. I want to be near you. I want to hold your hand. I want to put my arm around you. I value being close. That's nourishment when it's ongoing, when it's regular. It's routine maintenance. See, what you want to do is bring your marriage here to the car shop called the church. And you want to say, repair this marriage. It's falling apart. But when we look, the oil has never been changed. When we look, the tires have never been rotated. Nobody's ever put it on alignment. And you want to bring it to the big car shop so that we can do emergency surgery on your vehicle when if you just give it regular maintenance, it'll keep on running. That's what nourishment is all about. Then he says cherish. Cherish is to, 1 Peter 3 says, honor, treat as special. It says your wife is the weaker vessel. Understand your wife, she's the weaker vessel. Now that's been a misused verse. The only way a woman is weaker than a man is physically. She's not weaker intellectually. A lot more brilliant women than men. Attitudinally, she's built physically weaker. The word there, weaker, is not weaker in the sense of less than. The word there is weaker has to do with the way you handle highly valued material. In other words, fine china. You don't treat fine china like paper plates because it breaks easily. But it breaks easily, and the reason you handle it carefully is because of how much you value it. It's a value issue. A man is to value his wife like fine china. The word cherish means to heat up or warm, and it was used of a bird that would put its feathers over its young ones. It says you're special, top priority, number one. It affirms her dignity. It says there's nobody like you. You're in a class by yourself. She always feels like she's number one. Cherish, to hold as unique or special, to hoover your feathers over because they're yours. Now, men want to regularly change their wives. Some men make it a life's goal to change their wives. You've been married for 5, she has not changed yet. Maybe your strategy ought to change. She's not going to change because you say change. She's going to change because it's in her best interest. It is in her best interest to change. And what will make it in her best interest, God says, Jesus says, is two words, nourish and cherish. You have plates that have not been washed for 2 or 3 days sitting in the sink. And now all of a sudden you're going to decide, I'm going to change this. So you start scrubbing on the plate. Scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing and try to get the mess off the plate. But you're frustrated because it's hard work. The easy way to approach this, soak them babies first. Run some hot water, put some soap powder in there, or dishwasher detergent, and just, excuse me, wrong thing. And let them soak. Now, when they soak in, you're not really doing anything. You're just putting them in an environment of softening. And that water, that hot water with the detergent gets in there and starts to loosen up stuff that was tough. Some of your wives are hard. Circumstances have made them hard. Life situations have made them hard. How they were raised have made them hard. Abuses they've seen have raised them hard. A domineering mother has made them hard. Maybe somebody told them you can't trust men. That has made them hard. And then you on top of that, you've made them hard. And all of a sudden now you're going to be the man and start scrubbing. Get off of dick. You're going to change. You're going to change. And you're scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing. And everybody irritated. She's irritated at you for pushing. And you're irritated because you got to push. And God's saying, why don't you soak it? Put it in the water and soak it with nourishing and cherishing and watch me loosen up the stuff. Because when it soaks long enough and hot enough, you wipe and don't scrub. The change becomes easier and more natural because the methodology is biblical and not secular. You've been listening to them boys on the corner talking about, well, I ain't gonna have no woman tell me what to do. I'm gonna go home and be man in my house, which is why they're on the corner. You're going to be out there with them if you listen. That's not a biblical methodology for change. It's routine maintenance. That's the continuous things, nourishing, and then cherishing, holding as unique and special. And over time, a woman whose heart is at least open to the Lord will be softened over time. Sure, there are exceptions. Sure, there are women who are rebelling against God. Sure. But that is the exception for a Christian woman because God has created Christian women in such a way that they are pliable, moldable in the right environment. And so he comes and says in verses 30 and 31, because we are members of his body, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He says we are members of one another. The reason why you nourish and cherish is because of a theological principle that is staggering and it should blow your mind. He says, the reason you do this is we are members of one another. Jesus has so connected himself with the church that you cannot talk about the church without talking about Jesus in the same breath. You can't talk about Jesus and not talk about the church in the same breath because they have interconnected themselves, members of one another. To put it another way, if Christ neglects the church, he neglects himself. For him not to address the needs of the church would be him. For him not to feed the church means he starves. For him not to address the church means that whatever he's not giving to us, he is losing himself because he has become one with the church. So what does he say? He goes over the marriage vow. Verse 31. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother. Now this is one of the most misquoted verses in the Bible. Please notice, men, it has nothing to say about a woman leaving her father and mother. See, we generally say, well, you leave your father and mother as though it equally applies to both. Uh-uh. It says a man is to leave his father and mother. Now, why? Because it's your job as the leader to establish something new, which means you are to sever any ties that you have that conflicts or competes with this new relationship. You are to take the lead in creating a security scenario that she can respond to. A man leaves his father and mother. Then it says a man cleaves to his wife. The word cleave in the Greek and the Hebrew means to stick like glue, super glue this new relationship. He says that you are to cleave. Now, what that means practically is no divorce. Malachi 2:14, God says, I hate divorce. And he's talking to men there for putting away their wives. He says, I will judge you for your divorce for an illegitimate reason. Why? Because in marriage you are to stick like glue. But then notice the last phrase. He says in the last phrase, and the two shall become one flesh. The man leaves, the man cleaves, but not till you get to the third line does the woman even come in. They. When the man leaves and sets up an environment of security and satisfaction, when the man cleaves, so she knows she is attached like glue to this relationship, then you become one flesh. Or to put it another way, you can't become one flesh if you're fighting to become two flesh. Because you're working in the wrong direction. You've got to say as the head of your home, I'm leaving anything that will compete with our relationship, and I'm going to stick with you. I am committed to you. There will be no divorce. The word will not come up in this house. I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to change my strategy, and instead of complaining, I'm going to start nourishing and cherishing, and I'm going to become the greater servant. And you will discover, he says, you will become, you won't start out this way, but you will become one flesh as needs are met. You're going to become one. But to take it the other way, to try to operate as two flesh, when you're supposed to be coming together as one flesh, means that there will be a breakdown in relationship and, oh, by the way, something else. God says, don't bother to pray about it. I'm not listening. Because how you treat her is how I will treat you. 1 Peter 3:7, that your prayers may not be hindered. So many, one of the main reasons why men are not getting an answer to their prayers is that your wife is not getting an answer to her prayers. She wants a husband who's going to care for her, a husband who's going to nourish her, a husband who's going to cherish her. And you keep saying, no, I don't have time. I got a football game. I got to do this. I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time to listen. I don't have time to think about you. I don't have time. 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 And then you come to church and you get on your knees and God is screaming from heaven, I don't have time. Don't ask me about that job promotion. Don't ask me to get that need met. Don't ask me about that situation. I don't have time. Why? Because we are members of one another. So the best way, men, to get your prayer answered is to answer her prayers. God will see you answer her prayers. He'll answer yours. Because we are members, he says, of one another. When you get married, you are creating something new. When you have a child, do you know what? You're creating something new, something that never existed before. When you and your husband have a child, you're creating something new. But the newness is the combination of one flesh. You only get a baby because there's been the coming together of two making one in a joint way so that these two cells connect and create something totally brand new that never existed before in the form of a child. The same thing you do with a baby, God wants you to do with a relationship. Create something new. But that's hard when you've been used to being something old. You've been being, a lot of us have been messed up. We were messed up by our mamas. We were messed up by our fathers. We can't create something new because we're still locked into something old. In a country years ago, there was a man, there was a custom that when you wanted to go get a wife, you brought cows with you. And you would trade the cows for a wife. The younger and the prettier the woman was, the more cows. The older and uglier the woman was, less cows. There was a man who had two daughters, one young and voluptuous, the other older and haggardly looking. He heard that the rich man in town was coming to look at his daughters and was bringing cows with him. He thought to himself, whoa. Well, if he chooses the uglier one, the older one, well, I'll be fortunate to get like one cow for her. But if he chooses the younger one and the beautiful one, which is obviously the one he's going to choose, I might get three or four cows for her. And of course, cows meant farming and milk and all the other things. So it had high value. So he told the daughters that this rich man in town was coming. And as the rich man came, he saw 10 cows. The rich man had come with 10 cows, far and above anything that had ever been paid in this town before. 10 cows. He gets the younger daughter. He calls her aside. Come on, get ready. This man is bringing 10 cows. This is going to be great. He gets the younger daughter ready. The guy comes up and looks at both daughters. He says, I will take the older one. Not good looking. No pizzazz. No zing. I'll take her. I will give you 10 cows. He said, whoa. 10 cows for her? She my daughter and I love her, but 10 cows for her? Off he went with his new bride, leaving 10 expensive cows behind. He got married, went on their honeymoon, set up house, and about a month later, he got to see his daughter again. Oh, but what he saw was not what he gave away. He saw his daughter and had to look and say, whoa. She was magnificent. She was had become more beautiful than the younger daughter. But how could this be? Simple. When she saw her value in the eyes of her husband, when he says, it don't matter how you look, you're worth 10 cows to me, she decided to become a 10 cow woman. She said, if he thinks of me as worth 10 cows, I'm gonna start walking like a 10 cow woman. I'm gonna start making myself look like a 10-cow woman. Some of you are here saying, I married the wrong woman, but you don't understand. If you treat the wrong woman like she the right woman, she'll become the right woman. But on the other hand, if you treat the right woman like she is the wrong woman, she'll become the wrong woman. So begin treating her like a thoroughbred, and you won't wind up with an old nag. Decide what you want her to be, how you want her to look, and then nourish it and cherish it. But there is one final question. You're saying, you don't know Susie like I know Susie. Oh, what a girl. You cannot begin to imagine all the needs this woman has. You're talking about a normal situation. My wife is not normal. Girl messed up. How can I ever begin to meet all this, that needs that this woman has? Simple. My God shall supply all your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. See, what you forgot is, it's not just up to your ability to meet her needs. God says, if you begin doing what you can do, I'll funnel from above that which you lack, so you'll get the bonus necessary to provide what she needs. Because you too have a provider who is in heaven, who will give you the grace to minister the grace where the grace is needed. So before you think about a divorce, before you think about how we're going to make it, before you think about throwing in the towel, become a nourisher and cherisher. In fact, I challenge any man in the room to take the next 90 days and become the greatest in the home through a servant. Say, I'm going to serve you for 90 days. I'm going to serve you for 90 days. Not because it ends in 90 days, but I just want to see what difference a maintenance agreement can make. And so you put out there a 90-day warranty with the understanding that if the service is good, she'll renew the contract.